Welcome to Sabbath School. We're so glad that you've joined us, and we're excited about the season which is before us. Even though we're talking about lessons in January and February already, we're, of course, in Christmas season. We want to thank the Magnets for the beautiful flowers up here. Let's begin with a word of prayer, and we'll ask the deacons to be ready, and we'll proceed. Our kind and loving Father, as we turn once again to the book of Ecclesiastes and look at our mentor for these lessons, Solomon, may we realize what got him into the problems that he was in, and may we not make his same mistakes. Is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. As I'm sure you must know, chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes is the famous chapter about time. We'll look at that in a moment, and very specific. You know, there's a time for this and there's a time for that. There seems to be a time for everything. And Solomon is most of all concerned about the time to die. Now, I don't know. I suppose that we could have a very interesting discussion if people were willing to be honest. If we said, okay, what are your concerns? What are your questions about death? That could obviously profit us probably, and we could have quite a discussion. But the interesting thing in Solomon's case here in the book of Ecclesiastes is he seems to be very concerned that when it's all done and said and we die, there's no difference between humans and animals. Is that true? Is it true, and he's going to ask several questions about that, he seems not to have any awareness that there is a certainty of life after this life. And you wonder about that, and that's one of the questions we're going to try to address here. Are we sure that there's life after this life, and on the basis of what? Are we nothing more than animals or even worms that just we live for a while and we're gone and that's it, it's all over? And one of the other concerns that he has in connection with that is he has no way of knowing what's going to happen after he dies. And he seems to be very worried about that. Are you worried about what's going to happen after you die? Should that be a major concern for us? Well, think, anybody, I mean, you're welcome to speak up at any time. What do we do with those kinds of concerns? Should we be worrying about it? Because we don't know for sure what's going to happen after we die, Lorna?
We have the New Testament, and we have the story of Jesus and Lazarus. Mm-hmm. Pretty clear what happened
to Lazarus. But that's cheating, because Solomon didn't have that. Now, what did Solomon have? Do we know what? Did he have any basis on which to see any hope? Can you think of anything that would say there's something beyond this life that was available to Solomon? Time to get those wheels turning. Larry.
Oh, would he have had the story of Enoch?
Sure.
That had been handed down mouth to mouth from the patriarchs. That says, you know, there are, and Elijah and Elisha and the whole history of the population that he grew up from, that they had this idea that there was something beyond.
Yeah. So that would suggest at least that there's another place you could go to. That still doesn't absolutely answer the question, if you die, do you miss out on the Enoch chance? Do you have to be translated to be an Enoch? Or is there a life after death? What do we know? What do we know about that? Think back. Now, try to put yourself in Solomon's place. What evidence did he have for life after death?
Job.
Yeah. Moses wrote Job, didn't he? And what does Job say? He says, I'm sure that there's a reward for me, I mean, in his own words. I'm sure there's God has a plan for me after my death. So at least that he had. So does this mean then that Solomon had not done his homework? Or he wasn't sure about the story of Job? You know, one of the things we've discussed in some of my classes is this. How different would the Old Testament be if the people in Old Testament times had really known and understood the story of Job? I mean, there's almost no evidence. The book of Job, according to Ellen White, was the very first book written, or at least it was probably written about the same time Genesis was written. But the rest of the Old Testament, it's almost as if Job didn't exist. At least in terms of really, really sort of comprehending what the book talks about. So we have for sure the experience of Job. Can you think of any other examples of that you might have cited to Solomon if you were alive in his day that would say, yeah, there is something beyond this life? Anybody? Yes, Lorna again.
I don't know what evidence there is in the Bible because I don't remember, but what did they know about the death of Moses? Did they have anything about that?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a very fair question because we know that Moses died, was resurrected, taken to heaven. Where do we get that evidence? Well, it's in Jude in the New Testament. Now, what they knew about that between the death of Moses and Jude, and how did Jude find out? Did Jesus tell him? Jude presumably was one of the brothers of Jesus. Did Jesus tell him that was a story, or was this a tradition that had been handed down? Well, in the book of Enoch, it talks about some of these kinds of things. And there's an apocryphal book called The Assumption of Moses, which we would say, you know, can't believe that stuff. But apparently that part of the story is true. Where did they get that information? We don't know. But there was that as well, and they knew about it. I mean, presumably they knew about the apocryphal books, whether they believed them or not. Ryan.
The promise was made to Adam and Eve of the Messiah. It was such a big deal. Eve hoped and prayed that Cain was it, and of course, mm-hmm. that Abel was it, and I'm not sure that...
Well, that's a promise for a Messiah, but...
Well, that's a life to come. That's an answer to all the questions. Mm-hmm. And Abraham looked forward to it. Mm-hmm. David, I mean, everyone...
Well, there's lots of good evidence that was true from the writings of Ellen White. It's not so obvious from the scripture itself.
That may be true. And it's a lot less obvious when you have a cloud of debauchery hanging over your head.
Yes. Okay. Well, Solomon goes on. He makes statements like, look at number four there. Nobody knows for sure that the human spirit rises to heaven or that the animal spirit sinks into the earth. That's the Message translation. The Good News Bible says, how can anyone be sure that the human spirit goes upwards while an animal spirit goes down into the ground? Now, we do have clear passages that says, God said to Adam, you came from dust, you're going back to dust. Now, does that sound like heaven? Now, how do you put that together? I mean, I guess that might have been one of the things that Solomon was struggling with. And I suppose today, and maybe this is one of the big questions that we ought to deal with in our lesson for today, even in our day, what evidence do we have and why do we choose to believe it? Now, Lorna has mentioned obviously the examples of Lazarus in the New Testament and the statements of Jesus and all the statements of Paul and the statements in other writers in the New Testament. Why do we choose to believe those? The Sadducees didn't believe in a resurrection. Not that we need to follow their example, but many people in our day don't believe in a resurrection. Why do we? Why do you choose? Is it just wishful pie-in-the-sky thinking? Is that why, you know, you hope it's true? Is that what we're talking about? Van.
When Jesus approached Mary after her brother had died, she seemed to indicate a clear understanding that he would rise again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where did that come from? Apparently there was oral tradition that told of these things.
Well, remember, however, that they were already good friends of Jesus, that family. He had stayed in their home probably many times before, so how do we know she didn't get it from him? Where did Jesus get his information? that's a good one. I think he had special connections. Well, anyway, getting back to the other question in this chapter, the question of time. If God is the one who chooses a time for everything, what happens if we're not doing God's will? There's time for nothing? I mean, you know. Do those passages there in Ecclesiastes 3, maybe we should just read them real quick like. Give me a second to put them up here on the screen. Let's look at that. Everything that happens in this world happens at the time God chooses. That means we have no independent choices of our own. What does this mean? He sets the time for birth and the time for death, the time for planting, the time for pulling up, the time for killing and the time for healing, the time for tearing down, the time for building. He sets the time for sorrow and the time for joy, the time for mourning, the time for dancing, the time for making love and the time for not making love, the time for kissing and the time for not kissing. He sets the time for finding and the time for losing, the time for saving, the time for throwing away, the time for tearing and the time for mending, the time for silence, the time for talk. He sets the time for love and the time for hate, the time for war and the time for peace, and so forth. There's the famous statement about time that you've all, I'm sure, read many times. What do we do with that? Do you feel like everything that happens in your life is clearly determined by God? Brian, did you want to say something too? I'm sorry. Don was ahead of you. Go ahead.
Where did my freedom go?
Yeah, exactly. So if there's a time for everything, and that's the next big question, how does that fit with my freedom? Yeah, is God sovereignly making his choices? Yes, Brian.
God has made it possible to grant individuals complete freedom of choice and still use that freedom to his blessing. Ellen White, in pulling back the drapes, so that we can look and see what's happening. The high priest, when Jesus, came, was chosen, and actually, I guess he could have come before or after, but he was selected. God didn't make him to be the way he was, but he used all of his attributes to God's benefit.
Okay. How do you know that?
It's the great controversy. Everyone has a part and plays a witness, mm-hmm. for good or for bad, and it's the answer. And if you're, Solomon is an example.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Larry, I think, had a comment down here.
Yeah, I see a difference, a great difference between God determining my future, coming from a predestination point of view, to God being aware of what my future would be, but not necessarily determining it.
Okay.
So that God can see into the future and with his wisdom know what paths I will take, but not determining them.
I spent some time looking on the internet. Oh, go ahead, Wally.
If we're talking about freedom, then I had a brother who lived 3 days and a sister who lived 1 day. What kind of freedom is that?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. There's a time for dying, huh? Well, I spent a little time looking on the internet, and I came up with some interesting things about time. Look at number 7 there. Time heals nothing. It merely rearranges our memory. Is that the way it is? Or time is a great healer, but it's also a lousy beautician. You ladies, I think, would probably agree with that. Time is like money. You can either spend, waste, or invest. Time is relative. The mind makes it slow. The heart makes it fast. Our friends make it worthwhile, and words make it timeless. Then a couple more. Time is the best teacher. Unfortunately, it kills all its students. And time is what keeps everything from happening all at once. Some interesting thoughts about time I just wanted to share. Van, go ahead.
There's another one you can add to that, and that is time wounds all heals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a famous one from way back. There's another little thing that maybe I could share with you real quick here, what people have said about time. Sometimes we waste a little bit. To realize the value of 1 year, ask a student who has failed his final exam. To realize the value of 1 month, ask a mother who has given birth to a premature baby. To realize the value of 1 week, ask an editor of a weekly newspaper. To realize the value of 1 day, ask a daily wage laborer who has 10 kids to feed. To realize the value of 1 hour, ask the lovers who are waiting to meet. Or to realize the value of 1 minute, ask a person who has missed the train. To realize the value of 1 second, ask a person who has survived an accident. To realize the value of 1 millisecond, ask the person who has won a silver medal in the Olympics. Treasure every moment that you have, and treasure it more because you share it with someone special, special enough to have your time. Don't measure your life by how many breaths you take. Measure it by how many times you get your breath taken away. Don't say you don't have enough time. You have exactly the same number of hours per day that were given to Helen Keller, Louis Pasteur, Michelangelo, Mother Teresa, Leonardo da Vinci, Thomas Jefferson, and Albert Einstein. So what are you complaining about? And then I like this one. It's slightly off the subject, but I mean, maybe this was partly Solomon's problem. I decided to take an aerobics class. I bent, twisted, gyrated, jumped up and down for an hour. But by the time I got my leotards on, the class was over. Love and time, the only two things in all of life and all the world that cannot be bought but spent. So what about those things now? Let's get back out of this. See if we can get to where we want to go here. So there are some very, obviously, people have said a lot of things about time, and time is a pretty major issue because time is what life is made out of. If you don't have any time, you don't have any life, right? Well, look at number 9. In God's great calendar, I guess we need to define a couple other things before we really jump into the meat of it. In God's great calendar of events, there are two different kinds of time. And this is something we've talked about before, and I'm sure most of you are aware of it, were aware of it before you ever came to this class. There is chronos in Greek, or chronological time. Chronological time is that stuff we've been talking about that clicks off every second or so, or thousandth of a second or whatever, and it's gone. There's no way you can get it back. That's it. It just keeps moving on. And you can set your cesium clock, if you like, and measure time down to, you know, billionths of a second, which is very necessary and very important in some cases. Or you can even set your clock by the stars. If you have devices for measuring those positions very exactly, you can set, you know, they will tell you, okay, the star, you know, the Earth's rotation has slowed down a little bit, so we're a few half seconds or something behind. What about that? Well, there's another kind of time, and that's called event time, which means that there's a right time to do this and a right time to do that. And, of course, I think that's primarily what Solomon was talking about here in Ecclesiastes 3. And that raises another question. Why do you think God chose a piece of time as the main monument of our relationship to Him? Think about that for a moment. Of course, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? I'm talking about the Sabbath. Jim.
Reading Abraham, Joshua, Heschel, it says, it's something that man cannot manipulate.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control time.
You can't speed it up. You can't slow it down. There it is. It comes when it's ready to come. We're talking chronological time now. We're not talking event time. We're talking chronological time. No way you have control over it at all. Is God trying to say something to us? Well, think, Lorna.
Well, I wanted to go back to the section and Solomon who wrote it. And I wonder if part of this is his excuse for some of his behavior. God did this. God set the time. This was all God. I just, you know, it just happened because it was God.
So he's saying these things because he's either saying, I'm running out of time and there's nothing I can do about it, or God has been responsible. God set the time for all the things that have happened so far, and therefore I'm not guilty, huh?
Right.
Which one do you think? Or both? Well, let's look back over here again. I'd like to say just a few more things about the Sabbath. We mentioned about it, that the Sabbath is God's monument. Think about people, and it's not so obvious today to us because we generally don't worship idols and other things like this. But in a society where people worshiped idols and images and so forth like that, and those were their gods, what would happen if you said, well, my God is time? You can't see it. You can't touch it. You can't put it in a bottle. You can't save it up. It's completely out of your control. Does that say something to us about our God? See, the reason why the heathen liked, and even the Jews themselves ultimately, really liked the idea of worshiping idols was what? What was the reason? You can manipulate them, exactly. You can put them over here, you can put it there, you can put it back in the corner and close the door and you do whatever you like out here. The God can't see you, right? That was their idea. But if you have something that's completely out of your control, some people are very frustrated by that. They don't like the fact that God's looking over their shoulder. In fact, I mean, that's what evolution and a lot of these things are all about. We don't need God. We don't want God looking over our shoulder, Don.
I think of the Sabbath, the purpose of it is to reflect on God's work instead of my own or man's work, you know. And in a sense, I can use the Sabbath as another work day if I just talk about my work, you know, or my profession or my endeavors, but to reflect on God's work, not only in creation, but what he's doing in redemption, salvation.
Okay. Another aspect, another thing about time that's interesting is that we've already suggested that Isaiah gives three criteria for determining, in order of importance, determining how you know for sure something is a God or not a God. And number one, you remember, is his ability to create from nothing. Number two is his ability to predict the future. And number three is his ability to do supernatural things. Now, since we're focusing on time, let's look at number two. What is the relationship between God and time? Does he live outside of time so he can, you know, just as I can walk up the aisle there, or I can walk back down, can God sort of go forward in time, go backward in time, just as if there were no, is there anything in God's world that's present? I mean, does he have a present, or is any point where he choose to go, is that present for him? Yes.
The reality is that's one thing God cannot do. He cannot literally turn a clock back. He can't go back in time any more than we can go back. Time is a constant. Now, he can manipulate, make the earth spin around a little faster so we measure it a little different. But still, the literal amount of time in the universe is constant. And he can no more go backward than we can.
Okay. John, you going to help us?
Yes, I think the opposite. I think he is in time, all time. I think his existence is reality. I think when Solomon gets to heaven, Solomon will be able to go back in time and forward in time and be present at all times that have ever existed. I think that's what the essence of our belief in eternity. And
you think we will be able to do it as well as God being able to do it?
I believe so.
Okay.
The reason I say that is because in his prayer, Jesus said...
Now, this is God speaking, remember.
Pardon?
Remember, this is God speaking.
Jesus speaking is God speaking. Well, yes, he said...
We're talking a conversation between two members of the Godhead.
Well, there's not a conversation. All the talk is from the Son to the Father.
Okay.
And he's...
The part that we have recorded.
Well, yes, that's all we have to go by.
Okay.
But he said, I, the Son, will be in you, the Father... Mm-hmm. And you, the Father, will be in me, the Son. Mm-hmm. And those that you have given me will be in me.
In us.
And they will also be in you. And so when you get it all blended together and bake it up, it's a loaf of bread that is the same all the way through. Mm-hmm. That's the whole of the eternity.
Okay.
It's always will be that way.
Okay. Anybody else? Lorna.
Well, in Revelation, they talk about, in a praise verse, the God who was and is to be. And that sounds like our time. Mm-hmm. We were and we are and we will be.
Okay. We hope that that will be our story, right? Don?
If we can go back in time, why didn't God, at the sin in the Garden of Eden, say, whoops, let's go back 3 days and live this all over again?
Yeah.
Well, you can't go back in time that way.
Can God do it, but we can't, or nobody can do it?
Only God.
What do you think? Brian?
God couldn't do it without violating our free will. I mean, our decisions, you know, what has happened is history. He's not going to change that.
Now, I think we would all agree that God has a record of everything that's happened in the past. And he can go back and he can look at that record and he can talk about it. He can show it to somebody, that kind of stuff. I don't think we would have a problem with that. We can do that. I don't think anybody would have a problem with that. But you're saying God can't go back and change the past.
Not without violating your free will or mine, right.
Okay. Down here? Oh, go ahead, Van, while this microphone's coming down.
I believe that God created the universe. Uh-huh. And I think everything in it, including time and space, was created by him. That there was nothing before. Scientists tell us that space is not nothing, which is hard to wrap your mind around. But space is something, and space and time are one thing. There's just two different ways of looking at it. Mm-hmm. So I don't see any limitations on God whatsoever. I think he can go back in time and go forward in time. But I think he's chosen not to do that, at least as he relates to us. And he's created time for us, and that's the thing we can relate to. Mm-hmm. And time will go forward with us, and he will go forward with us. But I don't see that as a limitation on him.
Okay.
Well, God tells us that he's the Alpha, the Omega, the beginning and the end. He created time. And time to us is relative. There's the past and the present and the future. And I think he's done that for our benefit so that we can relate. To him, he's omnipresent, he's omniscient, he can do anything and be anywhere at any time, so he can travel throughout time. Mm-hmm. But we can't. Mm-hmm. We have to live today. Even in the future, even in the next world, we're going to have time. Mm-hmm. We're still going to have our Sabbaths. So he's telling us that we take each portion of a segment of time to devote to him throughout eternity. So I think that time is different from us, from our standpoint, than it is from God's standpoint.
Okay. Now, one of the issues that comes up here... Oh, go ahead, Rose.
I think of time is circular when you... in one way.
Yeah. Well, ancients surely thought about it as circular. Yeah.
Yeah, because you come back to the Sabbath each week. Mm-hmm. The seasons mm-hmm. return all the time. And you know, a life is gone, a new life begins. And then I think Einstein had something to say about time.
Yeah, I've heard that.
In relationships. I don't understand it.
He did.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, part of what Einstein said about time, scientists are trying now to prove is not true. So that's very interesting. We'll see where that goes. Well, part of the question is, and we've said a lot about time here, and that's one of the main subjects, so I'm uncomfortable with that. But if God sets all these times, does it mean he's basically sovereign? He's responsible for everything that happens? If God either allows it, with Don and his freedom here, if God allows it or he causes it, is he responsible? You see, one of the reasons why a lot of people have trouble with some of these ideas, because if you have the devil involved and you say he's a being and you say God created everything, then God created the devil, God is responsible for sin. Yes or no? No, why not? He made the devil and the devil sinned, so therefore God must be responsible.
I don't think he created the devil, but I think he created the one that they call the beam of light or something.
Lucifer?
He became a devil after he was created. Mm-hmm. And I think that God allowed that to happen for part of the great experiment in creating something to have freedom to do what it wants to. Mm-hmm. Never take that freedom away from us.
Okay.
Of course, he has to take the life away from the one who lives a life that he hates so much that he would rather die than go on living in the condition that he worked himself into.
Okay. Jim.
Several times you discussed that sin is separation from God, and you've explained how that works. And of course, we find nothing can live separated from God. So who's keeping sin going? God's keeping it going, because mm-hmm. ultimately it would cease to exist if God was yeah. not sustaining it.
Yeah. Yeah, and how do we feel about that? Are we comfortable with God keeping sin going?
And we say, why is there evil? Three words: God is love. Mm-hmm. Love means choice, and without choice, you don't have love.
Yeah. John.
Well, last night I was in a very interesting class. And somebody asked, did God create evil? And I think we never did hear anybody answer it. But doesn't Isaiah tell us that God says, I create good and I create evil?
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
Okay.
Isaiah
45:7.
Oh, you even got the place.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. So what do we do? Don?
I think God knows who he is, and this is why he can live without regrets. He is love, and he came to reveal that love to Judas as much as John, as much as Peter, as much as Manasseh, as much as the Sodomites, and all of them, love and truth, I should say. Mm-hmm. And so he's giving every nation, every opportunity, even Pharaoh, an opportunity to see his love, or at least his truth, and very clear, and turn it down, you know. And so if you want love response, you can't force it. And it's just like nature tells us. He causes the sun to fall on the righteous and the unrighteous, and the rain and so forth. So just because I'm a millionaire or a billionaire doesn't mean I'm being blessed of God. Well, I am blessed of God, but doesn't mean I'm not an awful crook.
Okay. Okay, Van.
You know, I think in a sense you can say that God is responsible for sin. But if you stop there, then you're in deep trouble. We have to continue with the thought that, okay, who's responsible for the resolution of sin? Mm-hmm. And that will be God as well. And then will there be sin again? And no, there won't be, because he's putting it to rest permanently. Mm-hmm. So I think in a sense, you know, for a time he has winked at this. And he's allowed it. And I think the resolution will be a timeless resolution.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, go ahead, Don.
Line of reasoning really bothers me.
Okay.
We're getting very close to saying sin was necessary, and that is not true.
Okay.
Because God would have created something that caused all this trouble, and we're on a very dangerous path.
Well, you know that there are major church groups who teach that, and we don't belong to them. But yeah, it's very true. So what do we? How do we resolve this? Well, of course, it's a mystery, in a sense. To be very honest, our freedom. God says, "I want love. In order to have love, I have to allow freedom. And when you allow freedom, sooner or later, very likely, and here's where evolution comes in, if you will, sooner or later it's going to happen, right? That's the basic premise of evolution. If God allows it, then sooner or later, and of course, we then would have to ask ourselves, well, why does God put himself at risk like that? And the answer, of course, is that freedom means a great deal to God. He's willing to let people die. He's willing to let us go through all these awful things that the human race has been through. He's willing to die himself to make sure that that freedom is preserved, that that love is preserved. What does that mean to us, Van?
Yeah, this is a very complicated question, and you have to be very careful with your answers and analysis, like Don pointed out. God has created untold number of worlds where sin has not been an issue. No one has sinned. Only on this little planet has this occurred amongst planetary beings, but it occurred right next to God in heaven by his highest created being. So there had to have been freedom for this to occur, because you can't say that he did it behind God's back. You know. So in a sense, God allowed this to occur. But I think the reason for that, or a reason for that, would be, what alternative would any being have that was known? Now that sin has entered, we have information on that. We have information on sin. We have information on the consequences of sin. Mm-hmm. We have information on not sinning and the consequences, therefore. And so, as a result of this sin experiment, in quotes, if you will, everyone in the universe will have information on all sides that they will make up their minds on, and I think it will not become an issue in the future.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
When we're studying the book of Ezekiel, we learned that God told Ezekiel to tell the people that he's not doing it for their good, but for his own sake.
Yes.
A lot of things God allows to happen to show his character, to develop his plan. And maybe sin's part of that. Sin, mm-hmm. God allowed sin to for his good, not for a bad purpose, mm-hmm. but for his good, to show his character.
Yeah, and certainly we hope that after all, the freedom has been exercised. Well, I shouldn't say after all. The freedom will never go away, in my opinion. But when God sees, and the universe sees, the results of God exercising this freedom and what it implies about him and his relationship to us, hopefully we're all going to come out and say, that's the kind of God we like. That's what we want to see. That should be where we ultimately go. Well, one of the things that bothers a lot of people in Solomon's list of things here is the time to kill. Are you all exercising your time to kill? And that's not talking about killing time here. As far as I know, there's no evidence that he's talking about killing time. What do we do with this? I mean, does God really say, okay, you know, every time, there's a right time for you to be out there killing? John.
Well, after I became a Christian, I was pretty much disappointed with my performance. Before that, I was in the service 2 years, 1 month, and 14 days, and
okay.
The government of the United States was willing to give me charge of a fire control center.
Oh, boy.
The control was of 155 howitzers. I mean, they made a big boom, and I watched them through the field glasses because I was a forward observer for that unit. And I was proud that I saw my targets disappear because I was helping my fellows. I mean, to silence their guns was a good deed, and that, I think, was a time to kill. Just you're asking, is there ever a time to kill? Well, I think there was. But would there be a time for me now to kill? I am a changed person. I do not find that I could ever have another time to kill. But I would not criticize or judge another one who finds a time to kill.
Well, you know, I'm sure you've all heard the at least hypothetical stories. Some of them are probably based on real facts, but the hypothetical stories that military people have come up with to try to pose questions to, you know, conscientious objectors or conscientious cooperators, as we like to call ourselves. You know, you happen to have a gun in your house, and here's a thief coming in and he's attacking your wife. What are you going to do? Okay. Or an even tougher one than this, suppose you're a medic in the military, and as it turns out, there's a bomb crater or something out there in the middle of the field, and somehow or other you were out there, and there's several people around you that have been injured, and so you pull them into this crater and you're trying to take care of them in this crater, and you're whatever, and here they are lying there with their weapons. You don't have a weapon because you're a medic, you're a conscientious cooperator, but all these guys are lying there with their weapons, and all of a sudden you see a half a dozen enemy coming over the horizon. You know they're headed straight for you. Now, it's not just you that's going to go down. All these guys are going to go down, and there's the weapon. They haven't seen you yet. All you have to do is pick up one of those weapons and... Is that a right time to kill? Yes.
Well, isn't the time to kill, time to do these things, part of our freedom of choice? I mean, if God gives us the choice to accept what he says or doesn't say, but doesn't give us time to do it, then he's controlling us. So he has to allow us the time to do these things, even though they're not his will, that he gives us the time and the choice to do them.
Do you remember what Solomon's father was famous for? Killing. Well, all through his life, he was a famous general. God finally said to him, I'm sorry, you can't build this temple that you'd like to build. Why not? I mean, you've killed too many people. He killed a lot of people, and I expect to see David in heaven. I think you probably do too. Don?
I think that God recognizes that we're born in a world of confusion that's way off the track and deceived, and this is why he's willing to meet us where we're at the level of understanding and growth that we have, and willing to work with us. It's amazing.
So... If you're more mature, there's not a time to kill, but if you're less mature, there is a time to kill?
Well, he had to speak in language that we understand. It's like Abraham with all those, cutting up all those animals. I think God hated to see that, but that's where Abraham was at, and he's willing to use a method that he would understand. Same way with Samson. But when we come down to Jesus, how many jawbones did he pass up, see, and God took care of him. I mean, he walked right through him, right?
Yeah.
And they wanted to kill him. I was brought up not even to play with a gun, much less you get a real one, you see. So I wouldn't have that skill. If I was in that, I'd have to use what defense I had. Maybe it'd just be prayer, you know. And I think God will honor that if it's my time, if I fulfilled his purpose, maybe I'll go.
So you, for you then, there isn't a time to kill.
Well, yes, I think there is. I lived in the state of Michigan, and the productivity of deer in Michigan is so great that if they didn't have a hunting season, they'd actually take over the state. Now, maybe he could get rid of those deer through natural means, like he was going to go into the land of Canaan. You know, he has, I'm sure, a lot of means, but at least
mountain lions do pretty well.
What's that?
Mountain lions do a pretty good job.
Well, I don't know how. Maybe they don't have enough mountain lions there.
Okay, Rose.
In the Old Testament, when the Israelites were going into the Promised Land, God wanted the Israelites to clear out the Philistines, and it was they got into trouble because they didn't.
Yes.
And so, and God was helping them at times. God was doing the killing.
Yeah. You look at some of the famous battles, the famous battle of Jericho, the battle of when the sun stood still was for Joshua. Who was doing most of the killing? God was. The walls fell down in Joshua, I mean in Jericho. Who did most of the killing? God did. If you read the story about the time when Joshua had the sun stand still, most of the people were killed by hailstones. Who sent the hailstones? Wasn't Joshua. So apparently God thinks there's a time for killing. Yes.
I think it's a matter of individual choice. You have to make up your mind one way or another. And getting back to the thou shalt not kill in the King James, the actual translation is closer to thou shalt not commit murder. I think there's a difference between cold-blooded murder versus protecting yourself. I've rubbed shoulders with a lot of killers, men and women. I have no doubt in my mind there are people that are not fit to live. Now, do I want to go around killing them? No. But I've made the choice if someone comes through my door, and there's always a chance that they might, in view of my past work, I know what I'm prepared to do. I hope I never have to do it. But I'm not against prayer, but I think sometimes God expects you to take care of business yourself. Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay, Brian.
It's interesting to read Mrs. White's description of the devil's response to men, you know, fighting and killing each other, the clapping and the joy that he has. It doesn't speak like that when God did it. It talks about when men are at war. I mean, that speaks to the end of their choice, and he's happy to have things wrapped up in that way.
Wally.
A mother with a son had severe cancer, had only a few months to live, wanted to take the son's life, eventually got approval, but was taken to court by the state after he died. Is she guilty or not?
Maybe we better get Dr. Kevork in here to help us with that one. Oh, we got to. Is that my... Somebody. Okay, yes. Got a hand.
I was just wondering if you can go to 23.
Okay.
Ellen White's comment about time as a talent.
Yes.
And what does that mean?
Well, what do we mean when we say talent? What is she talking about here? Time is a talent. Does that mean you can measure it out on a scale? Talent was a measure of weight a long time ago, but it's come to have other meanings now. What does talent mean to us? Nobody knows. It's a gift. It's a special responsibility. You have it. It's something you have of value, and now you're responsible for it. So do we have time? Well, we read that little thing says you have the same amount of time as Albert Einstein and, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Louis Pasteur, etc. Yeah, it's a gift. We all have it. What do we do with it? You know, and I really see this every day because I take care of a lot of people who have just awful lives. And part of the reason a lot of them have awful lives is because they do absolutely nothing. And I sometimes think, man, I wish there was a way I could get these people to do a few things that I need to do. You know, here they are just in here sitting on a chair in my office and you know, they're sort of blup, there they are. And they sort of make their way in and they sort of make their way out and they hardly have ability or the energy to do anything, it seems like. And what do you do? No, I don't work. I just sit at home. And then, of course, they want the U.S. taxpayers to pay for them to sit at home. So time is a talent. And God has given you that time. He's given every one of us time. And he expects us to do something worthwhile with that time, not just to waste it. As we said up there earlier, you know, killing time is not murder. It's suicide. By the way, getting back to our killing thing, the word for kill in the sixth commandment is not the same as the word for kill here in Ecclesiastes 3. So we could argue about how much those words are similar, but at least it's a different word. It's not talking about a time to commit murder here in Ecclesiastes 3. So what does it mean for a time to kill? Well, you know, I guess we'll leave that. I don't know if we... Did we answer your question?
Yeah.
So, it's a responsibility. It's a privilege and a responsibility that God has given us. And it's a big... I mean, that's what we have. Yeah. Depends on what we do with it. Yes.
God's biggest enemy is sin, and he wants to kill sin. So when he's talking about killing, he's killing sin, not the person...
Like the story of the Quaker, wasn't it, who came out of his house and there was this thief out here that was like he was trying to steal his cattle and so forth. And he's pointing his gun straight at the guy and he says, "I would do thee no harm for the world, but I'm about to shoot where thou art standing." is that the way it works, huh? John?
Well, I think time to kill includes time to kill mosquitoes who are shouldn't be on my face,
causing disease
and that kind of thing.
Okay.
You don't really change nature very much or upset the balance if you kill the mosquitoes who try to eat you.
Well, let's be thankful that we kill flies. I don't know how accurate these calculations are. Obviously, I haven't done them myself, but I read a little scientific blurb one time that said that if every fly reproduced and all the children survived and there was enough food for them to survive in one season, starting about March till about October, the earth would be covered with flies 49 feet thick. So I'm thankful that there's some kind of control. Okay. What about, we've talked about, I'm trying to pull all these things together because we're running out. In fact, I better skip that one, and we're not gonna make it. What's the relationship now between God's foreknowledge and my freedom and time? And specifically, and we only got a couple minutes left, a few minutes left, but I would like to ask you this: does God's ability to predict the future, even God's giving prophecies in the Bible, does that strengthen your faith, or does it raise more doubts in your mind? Now, you know that a lot of people have serious problems with God's ability to predict the future. They don't believe he can. They have all sorts of ways to try explaining away the prophecies. What about that? How does God's ability to predict the future impact you, John?
Well, I think it's back to that idea that when we are in him and he is in us and the Son is in him and the Son is in us, I think we understand what it means that he can see the future, because I think he sees all of creation at once. Mm-hmm. And we will too if we're in him, mm-hmm, and if we're in the Son. Mm-hmm. So this idea of his foreknowledge, I think, is tied directly into what he can see.
Okay. Don.
Well, I kind of like, when I read the King James and that in me and all of that, what he's talking about, didn't make much sense to me. So that's what I like, is that Phillips says in union with. Mm-hmm. Made a lot more sense, because even God had, they each have a different personality. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Holy Spirit is divested of a human personality, but he still has his individual personality. But they all work together as one purpose. And like good parents hopefully do, but they aren't the same person. But back to what was the other question you asked?
Which one?
the one that I had a thought on that. What was that question you asked that John started to respond to?
Foreknowledge. The question about does prophecy in the Bible, does it strengthen your faith? Does it?
I think
worry your faith.
I think it certainly helped the disciples, because they misinterpreted the whole purpose of Christ's mission. Mm-hmm. And when I look at faith as confidence, putting confidence in someone, many things that Jesus told them, when it came to pass, they realized, that gave him more credibility, mm-hmm. you know, that he knew the future because it happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's probably a better reason for prophecy, to put more confidence in the person that is giving the prophecy rather than just telling you about some future.
Well, if you see God predicting something hundreds of years in advance, and time passes, and then you're able to say, yes, it happened exactly as he predicted at the time when he predicted, that clearly is beyond my abilities. That's clearly something in the realm of God and the supernatural. Now, we could start arguing about whether the devil has the ability to do that or not, but certainly God does. And he in Isaiah says that's one of the criteria that sets him apart, that makes him God, that sets him apart from idols, for example, very clearly. Well, our time is up, and so we need to close, but in this chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, we have a lot of issues raised by Solomon. He just raises them. He doesn't deal with them. And we've pretty much done the same kind of thing. I guess the last question that I would leave with you as you leave is there a right time for God's judgment? John 12:31 says, now is the judgment of this world. And Jesus was talking about his life and his death here on this earth. In what way is the life and death of Jesus a judgment for you? And I'll let you go home with that thought. Let's pray. Our kind and loving Father, we thank you for even these puzzling and challenging parts of Scripture. They give us reason to think, to scratch our brains, which we believe is exactly what you wanted us to do, to use our brains as much as possible to strengthen them, to think thoughts after you. So this morning, we thank you for this opportunity in Jesus' name. Amen. You may need to, or you may want to recognize that because we did two sessions on Revelation last week, we're going to do two Sabbath school lessons today. So the next period will be a second session.